Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Your future is important. Take time to plan for what can go right. Talk to a financial broker about a Zurich pension.
Now, as we've been hearing, the government has just published its long-awaited revised climate action plan outlining what measures will be taken to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and achieve the targets set by government for each sector. For more on this, we're joined now by Saif O'Neill, lecturer and researcher in climate policy. And you're welcome, as always, Saif, to the programme. I know this was only published in the last half hour or so, and it runs to 300 pages, so you've only managed to take a look at some of it. But maybe you can talk us through some of the highlights.
Yes, I'm delighted. Thanks very much for having me on. I've only looked at a couple of the chapters and not even all of the chapters that I looked at in detail. And what I was particularly interested in was in the introductory section on citizen engagement, where it referenced the need for a strengthened social contract, because a lot of these measures have been widely anticipated. And even last year's Climate Action Plan measures were quite radical in many respects. Lots of detail, lots of very specific things that have to be done. So the question is, how do we get the buy-in? How do we get long-term credible commitments that will drive the changes that we need to see out to 2030 and even beyond that? Because ultimately, we have to get to net zero emissions. And that is a very ambitious and transformative set of changes we'll have to make. So the plan references the need for a strengthened social contract. And I just wondered what that might look like in practice, because it's not just about getting the public to do what you want them to do. It has to involve all political parties. And in some countries, they've actually gone to the extent of drawing up cross-party agreements on climate change to ensure that you have policy consistency when there's a change of government or over longer periods of time. We're going to need to find new and exciting ways of mobilising and involving the public. And I think that's going to have a critical role there for political leadership. Sometimes that has been wanting, even with the current government, where you have commitments to climate action. Some junior ministers and some ministers seem to interpret that, you know, in a kind of very flexible way and are not necessarily buying into some of the changes that are needed.
Okay.
So political leadership, cross-party agreement, and that's the route to a strengthened social contract, I think.
Okay. The Minister, Eamon Ryan, is on his feet speaking at that press conference at the moment, along with Leo Varadkar and Micheál Martin. And I know Eamon Ryan has said in the last short while that he believes transport will be the most challenging. What is this saying about transport that you've seen?
Yes, well, the transport chapter, which I haven't completed reading, is very interesting because it reflects a new study that was produced in the last year by the OECD. So the transport chapter is the first one where I see a really significant paradigm shift in thinking, because for the first time it says we have to stop our car-dependent approach. We have to stop facilitating the car in our planning and even in our buildings when we are designing and building them. So it's all about moving away from car dependency, this avoid, shift, improved model, where you try to shift people away from the car by offering alternatives and by encouraging people to take up new public transport routes, which are going to be provided, and also to improve the efficiency of the system that we have. So there's some very interesting targets there, a 30% reduction in car trips to school. So the school commute needs to be a thing of the past in urban areas. We need to encourage kids to be able to use their bikes or scoot or walk to school and to enable them to use public transport as well. There's some interesting measures there on public on car parking. And there's going to be guidelines given to local authorities so that they can implement these active travel and planning policies at a local level. Because without the local authorities getting behind this, it just won't happen.
And I don't know what detail you've seen on car parking at this point, Saif, because there was some reporting in advance that there might be a reduction, for example, in car parking.
Well, I just had a quick glance through the chapter and there are quite a few references to it, but they don't seem to have very specific measures. They seem to be linked to the planning policies and these guidelines that they're going to give to local authorities. I didn't have a chance to find out where the public sector car parking spaces are going to go. But ultimately, that's what it needs. I mean, we all need to get behind this. Companies need to get behind it. The civil service needs to get behind it. All state actors and agencies, companies that have large car parking, you know, facilities for their employees need to develop transport and mobility plans to reduce their climate impact by helping their employees get to work in different ways.
One of the lines that really jumped out at me is this commitment that 70% of rural Ireland will be guaranteed three buses a day by 2030, which I think many people in rural Ireland would very much welcome if it was coming their way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the chief criticism of the push for public transport of active travel from rural communities is that they didn't have the services. So here you see the effect of a sort of clear commitment in the programme for government to reallocate public transport, transport expenditure away from road transport and private transport into public transport and active travel. So unlike other areas, the funding is actually committed. So the issue is having enough pathway projects, these pathfinder projects, to roll out the new public transport services, okay, rail, bus, and new rural transport routes where they didn't exist before. So, but the funding is there. The question is, can we roll out the services in time and encourage people to use them?
Another key area, of course, is agriculture. That has a 25% reduction target in its sectoral limits. What have you seen there? What's jumping out at you?
Well, what's jumping out at me is that we have more of the same. There's an emphasis on reducing nitrogen use, but there are no specific policy commitments to ensure that that happens. So it's assumed that the effect of higher prices on nitrogen, chemical nitrogen, is going to kind of basically shift farmers towards multi-species swards and organic farming. But there's no particular policy instrument. It's all nudges. So I'm not confident that the measures in the agricultural chapter are achievable, even though the targets are much less ambitious than for other sectors. And again, as you've highlighted, it's entirely voluntary. It's all about kind of encouraging and, you know, supporting and kind of throwing out targets and please do this, please do that. But there's no specific guarantee that these targets will be met because there's no policy instrument to drive it. And then one of the things that struck me is a commitment to have up to 20 anaerobic digestion plants in place by 2025, which seems extraordinarily ambitious given that these would all require planning permission and all the usual things that can cause delays. So that, I'm just wondering, you know, to what extent these are really deliverable without much firmer action and, you know, more stringent approach to agricultural policy that's driven by the carbon budgets. Mm. We're sort of still operating in a world where it seems that agriculture can self-select its own policies, and I just don't think that's going to be compatible with the constraints we have to operate
under. Finally, and very briefly, if you don't mind, again, the herd, and I know it's much bigger than the herd, but there was reports in advance that there might be some cutting of the herd. There's no mention of this here, but there is talk about expanding the use of tillage farming, or expanding tillage farming rather, to 400,000 hectares. I think it's 300,000 hectares at the moment, which I suppose would mean the use of the land would be, instead of being used for dairy farming, would be used for tillage farming.
Yes, I mean, it's hard to imagine how we're going to do any serious climate mitigation in agriculture without change in our land use pattern away from predominantly livestock farming towards other other methods, other farming types, horticulture, tillage, forestry and so on.
So that target, Saive, would that be sufficient, do you think, if we got to 400,000 hectares of tillage farming?
I really couldn't say whether it would be sufficient or not, but the key thing is what will make farmers do that, what will make them make those shifts. Mm. There are quite significant changes in practices for existing farmers. They might require training and other supports to make those changes. So I'm not sure how quickly they can adapt. So diversification, like everything else, needs resources, it needs training, and it needs a kind of suite of policies and measures that are going to drive these changes and make sure that we stay on target.
Well, we might get some of those details from the Minister after 5 o'clock. Thank you very much for joining us for now. That's Saive O'Neill, lecturer and researcher in climate policy.